This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Video games have been around for 60 years, and they have changed a lot over the decades. Longtime fans of the role-playing saga Final Fantasy have heard the victory theme, which plays at the end of a battle, go from this to this. No wonder that today the industry employs tens of thousands of people and makes about $138 billion worldwide. And has a lot of fans, myself included, because video games are a lot of fun. But are the things that make video games so much fun also what can make them addictive? This summer, the World Health Organization added a new illness to its international classification of diseases. The WHO defines gaming disorder as, quote, a pattern of gaming behavior characterized by impaired control over gaming and an increased priority given to gaming to the extent that gaming takes precedent over other interests and daily activities, unquote. Now, the debate about video game addiction has basically been around as long as video games have. What is this new classification? And what does it mean for gaming? That's just ahead on 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the NPR Wine Club. Discover hand-selected wines from award-winning vineyards around the world. Learn the stories behind each one and enjoy unique bottles inspired by your favorite NPR shows. All with the convenience of home delivery. A special welcome offer includes a bottle of Weekend Edition Cabernet Sauvignon. If you're 21 years or older, join in the fun at nprwineclub.org.
Hey, Asma.
Hey, Tamara.
We are the NPR Politics Podcast.
This week, Paul Manafort is on trial.
He, of course, is President Trump's former campaign chairman.
So when there's news from that trial, the NPR Politics Pod Squad will run out of the courtroom and bring you what you need to know.
Joining us to help answer these questions is Ian Bogost, a game developer and professor of interactive computing at Georgia Tech. He's written nearly a dozen books on video games, including his latest, which is called Play Anything: The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secret of Games. Professor Bogost, welcome to 1A.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Professor Bogost, I wonder how you view just this debate in general. There was anxiety about arcades in the 80s, violence in the 90s, video game addiction now. Is this just something that's inherent to video games, always has been, or is the debate different now?
We do see this concern come up every few years. Every 5 to 10 years, there's a new kind of moral quandary or panic over games. And you mentioned many of those that we've seen in the past. You know, there was a violence debate in the mid-70s over stick figures in certain arcade games. The question about addiction...
A debate over stick figures in video games?
Yeah, there was this game called Death Race that had, you know, very limited graphics. The sort of visual version of the little Final Fantasy quip that you played at the start, but you would run over these little stick figures with virtual cars. About 1975 that this took place, and people were up in arms about it because it seemed like this gratuitous violence. Exactly the same things we saw decades later in the 90s with Mortal Kombat and then with Doom. So, you know, the fact that we don't even know about some of these previous controversies, that we've forgotten about them, is indicative of the cultural state that games are often in. They're always this up and coming, maybe soon there'll be a mainstream medium that will come into fruition and become an adult form. And we've been waiting for that for years and years. And that's one of the things that contributes to these controversies when they arise again.
Paint us a picture of the game world today, the industry, the number of people who play, who plays. What should we know, broadly speaking, about the scope of games? Are we talking about a niche part of the population or the majority?
It's so interesting because it's kind of both. Many, many people play games. People play games because there are so many different kinds of games. You know, there are first-person shooter games, and there are sports games like Madden, and there are smartphone puzzle games like Candy Crush, and there are board games of the family kind and of the strategic kind. There are games that that people play with others. There are games that people play alone. There are games that are used for education or for business or for newsmaking. There's so many different kinds of games that it's hard to sort of hold them all in your hands all at once. It would be like talking about books or film in some way. There's all these different genres. And because of that, lots and lots and lots of different demographics play games. It's not just the stereotype of teenage boys in their basement, although a lot of teenage boys do play a certain kind of game with one another and over the internet. So at the same time as that's true, that you have millions of people playing games, spending billions of dollars, culturally, games remain this kind of niche influence, you know, this thing that people don't think that they do. If you ask a lot of folks who are obsessed with Candy Crush, let's say, if they're gamers, if they think of themselves as having an identity that's bound up with games, they would say, no, of course not. I just play the smartphone game when I'm in line for coffee sometimes.
And yet, when you go to the airport, everybody's looking down at their phone, or when you're on a subway, everyone's looking down at their phone, and almost all of them are playing Candy Crush or Two Dots or something like that. They're all playing a game.
Yeah, and this is really hard to explain to people inside of the games world, whether they're players or they're developers. I write a lot for The Atlantic, and when I write about technology or when I write about you know, other forms of culture, lots and lots of people connect and they read it. And when I write about games, many fewer do. It's still kind of a niche topic. Mm-hmm. And when it arises, it tends to arise in this kind of like black magic sort of way. Like, why is it that people are so compelled by Tetris? Or why are kids playing this online game Fortnite so much? There's always been this anxiety about games, even among those who play them but may not sort of recognize out loud that they do.
I do want to get more into that as we continue our conversation with Ian Bogost of Georgia Tech. Let's add another voice to the conversation now. Cecilia D'Anastasio is a senior reporter for the video game news site Kotaku. Cecilia, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for making time for us. Are there certain kinds of games that you find are getting the most attention? It seems like historically the popular one seems to be the one that's targeted. I mean, there used to be laws against pinball games related to gambling decades ago. And I wonder if there are certain genres or certain platforms for games that this debate tends to focus on today.
Well, you mentioned Fortnite, and I don't know if a week has gone by since it was released that a concerned parent hasn't written some post on some website about how much of it their kid is playing. I think there's a lot of conversation around that game in particular right now, yeah.
And I can, I've tried Fortnite. I can't. But describe Fortnite for us. It's kind of like a multiplayer shooting game that also includes some like creative engineering and architecture, right?
Yes, yes. Fortnite is a very, very fun game. It is a survival shooter. So 100 people are dropped onto an island, and the last person standing wins, and they have weapons at their disposal with which they can eliminate other players. Also, they are able to build fortresses to get high ground, to shield themselves. There's a lot of quick thinking and innovation, and it's a very reflex-based game, too.
Fortnite is also one of these games that's actually free to play. Like, there are a few games like Fortnite, which I could not get into, Warframe, which I am way too deep into, that cost nothing to download the whole game, but then you can pay for additional tools and power-ups and weapons. Is that right?
Correct, yes. Fortnite makes a killing off of selling costumes, selling, you know, different equipment for players, selling different emotes or sort of dances that players can do. And this is way these are ways players can express themselves in the game and build a stronger connection with their avatars in the game.
Tyler writes, I'm 32 years old and have been an avid PC gamer since my first IBM computer in the early 90s. For some of us, like me, we've used gaming as a way to cope and escape. I suffered for years a crippling anxiety disorder, and gaming with a community like World of Warcraft has helped me get through that tough time and eventually overcome my disorder through role-playing. Unfortunately, the gaming industry knows very well how to tap into those dopamine receptors and get you to keep playing. Daryl tweeted, gaming, I believe, is not an addiction. Granted, in my own experience, it seems more to be a coping mechanism for other mental issues. My family, I'm sure, considers it an addiction. Cecilia, what do you make of this? I hear plenty of people say that gaming for them is kind of a social coping mechanism. Is that part of the kind of way in terms of the concern over addiction, that is exploiting a vulnerable area?
That's a big question. Gaming certainly is popularly recognized as a coping mechanism for people who have social anxiety, people who have depression, and people who have sort of mental health conditions that might make it more difficult for them to interact with people in the day-to-day. And interacting with people in a video game when they don't know what you look like, what you do for work, what your grades are, what your family's like, can be a really beautiful experience for people who aren't able to have these connections when they go to school or in the office place. I think it's very, very important that people can experience that sort of social interaction. Do video game companies actively tap into that is a question you'd have to ask the game companies themselves. It's complicated. It's a more complicated question than do game companies actively target audiences who might want gambling type mechanics in their video games in order to create, you know, bigger money. Like the social aspect of it is a little more elusive.
Ian, we have to pause in just a second, but how do you see that in terms of tapping into that raw need?
Sure, you know, the fact that so many people socialize in games, these games are played online and they find community there and then they bring it outside of that online community. A lot of kids who play Fortnite have kind of brought it into schools, and that's had ups and downs as teachers find it hard to get their attention sometimes. So those pro-social things, they're there, but then also we have this draw, this sort of compulsion draw into games of all kinds, which is where some of the concerns arise.
Before we bring in our next few guests, Cecilia, tell us a bit about this World Health Organization decision. What exactly does it involve? Has it been in the works for a long time? Can you just give us the overview?
Sure. So gaming disorder is now recognized by the World Health Organization, and it's been in the works for a little bit. Part of what led up to this is the recognition of gambling disorder by the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is basically the Bible of mental health disorders. Gaming disorder is really interesting because it is an impulse control disorder rather than a substance abuse disorder. I think a lot of people are used to thinking of addiction in terms of some sort of chemical addiction, some sort of reactions happening in your brain. Gaming disorder is a little bit different. It encompasses this kind of compulsive desire to escape, this compulsive desire to play games, which I'm sure a lot of parents might recognize in their kids who are playing Fortnite right now. But on the other hand, it's distinguished from simply that compulsive behavior because it has a negative impact on your day-to-day life. It negatively impacts your grades, your social life. It has terrible repercussions.
Let's dive a little bit more into the nature of this, especially because a number of you have been asking questions about the finer points of this definition. Scott asked, is it really addiction or is it compulsion? Eric adds, is there any form of pleasure that is not addictive? And Dark Greg tweeted, why not list addictions to smartphones or Netflix or even TV? This is just an attack on a progressing norm. Apps like Facebook and Candy Crush have way more overuse, yet we attack video games? Let's discuss it with Dr. David Greenfield. He's the founder of the Center for Internet and Technology Addiction. He's also an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine. Dr. Greenfield, welcome back to 1A.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also joining us is Andrew Shibilsky, the director of research at the Oxford Internet Institute, which is part of the University of Oxford in England. Andrew, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Dr. Greenfield, I wonder if we could start by just kind of defining, as you know, in a broader sense, addiction, and marrying that to what we think of as video game addiction. Does the way we think of addiction classically match what we're talking about here?
Yeah, it does. And certainly the thing I want to start with is that we're not saying that everybody that plays video games has a video game addiction.
Right.
In fact, the overall percentages are fairly low. But the definition of addiction, if you look at the American Society of Addiction Medicine, which is sort of the premier organization that defines it, they really define addiction as an alteration in mood and behavior with compulsive actions to the deleterious impact in your life. And that can include symptoms of withdrawal, meaning that you have a reaction when you take away the drug or the behavior, by the way. So they define addiction really looking at either a substance or behavior. And if you look at the brain and the way the brain processes pleasurable behaviors, particularly in the limbic system, it really activates similar pathways. It doesn't really matter what the drug of choice is if you once you activate those pathways. They also talk about tolerance, meaning that you need more of it or more or variations of it. And there is a compulsive use in spite of the fact that you are having negative impact. So that's an overall definition. I mean, there's a lot more to it, but there has to be some real negative impact. So if somebody likes games and they're spending 4 hours a day or 6 hours or 10 hours or 1 hour, or if they're using it on bank lines and post office lines, that's fine. The way we got into this is that we had patients showing up with problems. So I came into it from the side of patients coming in with issues, and that's how we sort of backed into the field.
Andrew Shabilsky, how do you see the relationship between what we classically think of as addiction and this definition of video game addiction? I can imagine, I can see how one might think it fits, particularly the aspect of tolerance and needing more and more of an intense fix, so to speak, to get an effect. Video games are designed to be progressively more difficult and immersive, so it would kind of seem wired for that. But what do you think?
So I think on one side, I think a lot of the debate and the rhetoric here is kind of based on a colloquial versus a clinical definition of addiction. So I think a lot of times when people are referring to something that's fun or engaging or immersive, they'll call it addictive. Yeah. And so it's kind of like the language that people use in day-to-day life. And that kind of then carries over to what we might think when an authority figure in psychology or psychiatry talks about addiction. And that kind of mixes into our own thoughts and feelings and fears as parents or as policymakers. I guess the thing that's kind of a bit more substantive here is that actually these kinds of moves by the World Health Organization with ICD-11 and the American Psychiatric Association have actually gotten very, very far ahead of the evidence base.
ICD-11, that's the document within which this definition would be enshrined.
Yeah, the International Classification of Diseases.
Gotcha.
So basically national health systems have a chance to conduct their own research after the World Health Organization kind of puts out a proposed guideline for a disease. So just to put this in perspective, I think here in the UK, the process of kind of following up on ICD-10 has taken about 10 years, and they're almost done kind of getting in line with the World Health Organization. So it's kind of a pretty large bureaucratic kind of medical enterprise.
Let me get to some of your comments about the nature of video game addiction. James tweeted, "It sounds like video game addiction is an offshoot of gambling addiction, that need for instant reward and having to play and play and play and to keep receiving that reward or the possibility of that reward." The economic aspect also came up for Stephen U. Halley, who tweeted, "It used to be that you could buy the whole game for $50. That's not the case anymore. You can spend 10 times as much and still not own half of the content. They get you hooked and bleed you. They call these customers whales." Cecilia D'Anastasio, could you chime in on the economic part of this? I feel like that lends credence to the argument about gaming addiction. There are so many games out where you can pay nothing for the game just to get you hooked, and then you start spending money on power-ups, or a game like, say, Star Wars II Battlefront, which got Electronic Arts into huge water with gamers because they realized there's no way you could play your way through all the power-ups faster than paying for it, and they had to readjust the game. Like, the economic piece of this, I feel, is worth discussing.
Yes, yes. It's definitely true. Games have become not significantly more expensive over time, but have become significantly more expensive to produce. So you can buy a game for $60 in 2018, but the same game might have cost $60 in 2014 when you had fewer people working on it and your technology wasn't as high quality. And what game studios say is that these extra mechanics, loot boxes, cosmetics that players pay for is a way of kind of earning back some of the money that they spent creating these video games. And by design, a lot of these mechanics are predatory. In fact, there are lawmakers who are looking into ways to regulate around these mechanics because children who are under 18 can participate in them, often with their parents' credit cards. So that's definitely a problem. When it comes to how this plays into gaming disorder or gaming addiction, I've reported extensively on people who are addicted to video games, and very few of them have confided in me that they are addicted to these mechanics. I'm not saying that's not widespread, but I'm saying that there are other video games like World of Warcraft that hook people with social interactions, and there are other games like Overwatch that hook people with just how fun they are to play and how good the shooting mechanics are. So I'm not positive that these predatory game mechanics have 100% correlation to more people being addicted to video games.
We did get some comments from listeners about World of Warcraft. We'll get to those in just a minute. But Professor Burgost, how do you see the economic aspect of this possibly playing into the argument about addiction?
It's central to it. To me, this is an issue of regulation of consumer rights and protections more than it is an issue of behavioral science. And it's ironic. I mean, I think your listener who said, "Well, what about smartphones? What about social media?"
Yeah.
Put their finger exactly on the trouble with this whole notion of a gaming disorder. The worst offenders, when we talk about these kind of variable reward systems and drawing people in, borrowing some of the behaviors and design patterns from games and then applying them to social interaction writ large, this is, to me, a much more concerning social phenomenon than a lot of kids play Fortnite until it burns out as a fad.
Dr. Greenfield, Andrew Shabilsky, I'd like you two to react to two tweets in terms of how people use gaming to deal with other issues. Kathy tweeted, "It's difficult when your child has autism and uses games to release the stress of the challenges of the day that you and I regulate without much thought, noise, social encounters, etc." Michael writes, "I am a recovering drug addict and also a gamer. I have recently started using video games as a habit to help me avoid relapse. It helps me stay inside, doing something fun, and away from temptations, and it provides immediate gratification, something drugs also do." Andrew Shabilsky, what would you say to Kathy and Michael's comments?
Well, it's in both cases, their experience kind of cuts to where the evidence is right now. So unfortunately, these kinds of moves by the American Psychiatric Association and the WHO, because they've gotten so far ahead of the data, we don't really know if, you know, there are kind of characteristics like having an addictive personality or some kind of biological predisposition that would drive obsessive forms of video game play, or if obsessive forms of video game play kind of impact people kind of in a broader way, you know, psychopathology down the line. And, you know, what we're really left with are a number of people who gaming fits in a really complex way into their life and into their health. And because the research is of such low quality, we just kind of get stuck with these anecdotes. And I think that's very frustrating if you're a parent or if you're somebody who's in a position of need, because you have people who are speaking from positions of authority telling you that in some ways this thing that's part of your coping, this thing that's part of your life and part of your social environment, it might be as bad for you as a drug or drinking.
Andrew, could you clarify when you say that the research is of low quality? Can you give me like an example of the low quality that you're talking about that's particularly worrisome?
Yeah, so a lot of it's based on what are called convenience samples. So these are kind of samples that don't represent the general population. So it would be like doing research on heroin addiction, but only asking people around a clinic or a free needle exchange, how much they do heroin. From that, you would kind of draw an inference that actually the use of the drug is extremely high in the general population. And so what happens is a lot of behavioral researchers, they kind of do the equivalent thing. So some research shows, what I would consider poorly done research, shows that, you know, up to half of video game players might have a problem with gaming addiction. But our work, you know, we collect nationally representative samples in the UK, in Germany, in Canada, in the US. We find that less than half of 1% of people might have a problem. And so, like, because the methodology is so squirrely, what winds up happening is people draw these kind of very outsized inferences about what might be going on.
Dr. Greenfield, what do you think?
Well, I think there's a lot of truth to what's being said. I think the prevalence statistics are misleading right now. We don't have a agreed upon definition on the diagnostic side, and there aren't a lot of studies. There is an NIH study that's being done at UConn right now and we're hopefully, and that's including the treatment issues. So I think the percentage, at least from the data that I've gleaned, and I've probably looked at 400 or 500 studies that have been done over the last 20 years, I think the numbers are probably closer to around 1%. But we've seen numbers bandied about as high as 12% and 14%. And as low as certainly 0% or 0.5%.
I'm sorry. The numbers in terms of 12% or 14% of gamers are
prevalence.
Addicted.
Correct.
Okay. And not 12% or 14% of the general population.
Correct.
Gotcha.
Correct.
Gotcha.
And I don't think the numbers are even close to that high. However, I want to say that really, when we address these issues, we address them in terms of the people that are having problems in their lives in a context of their entire life, which would include other mental health issues as well. So that's very important to talk about, which I want to mention.
We will continue this conversation momentarily with Dr. David Greenfield, Andrew Shabilsky, Cecilia D'Anastasio, and Professor Ian Bagost. We'll talk more about the way that these games are made and the future of gaming addiction. Stay close.
Support for 1A and the following message come from American Express. These days, keeping up with everything in the news is hard, whether it's politics or pop culture. American Express believes it's always easier to stay ahead when there's someone behind you, easier to focus on what matters, to follow what interests you, to explore, to discover. And with American Express, you don't have to go it alone because they have your back. Don't live life without it.
Why do women get paid less than men?
Why does Louisiana State University have a lazy river and a tiger habitat?
The Indicator, a daily podcast where we tackle the big economic questions.
Quite a few of you wrote to us about the impact of World of Warcraft socially for you. Amanda wrote on our Facebook page, "My then boyfriend and I created World of Warcraft characters in college to allow for shared experiences and more communication in college. It started out as lighthearted fun and progressed to scheduling raids with our guildmates and grinding mindlessly, playing. Cameron tweeted, "My guild in World of Warcraft gave me an escape from the depression and isolation that I felt in high school and community college. I had close friends and confidants in the game, but we disbanded after one guild leader outed another as gay. It definitely gave me experience with very real social problems." Professor Bagost, I feel like the cultural conversation around video games changed dramatically once they became online multiplayer games. Then they kind of went from being purely recreational to being social and almost sociological.
It's funny. There's a lot of game designers who will say, you know, games were always social. You played card games, parlor games, board games, tavern games with other people. That was fundamental to them. And it was this accident, this historical accident of the PC and console era before the internet, when games became isolated, when they became kind of solo play experiences. And it's certainly true that thanks to the internet, we've returned to a form of gameplay that is social in the sense that you're playing more with other people. But that doesn't mean that that fundamental feature of games wasn't always kind of social too. It's just that it took a different form. Instead of maybe playing literally with someone else or against them, you were participating in some of the same challenges and strategies and sharing that information and those ideas away from the game. And outside of it. So we've had these kind of ebbs and flows in how pro-social we think games are, and there's always been a push and pull, a kind of conflict between games as isolating and games as socializing.
I wonder, though, in terms of the balance between the negative and positive effects, Dr. Greenfield, how we should view that aspect of it. Doug writes, "I think your guests are not giving the possible positive effects of spending a lot of time gaming in your teenage years. I have a son, now 26 years old, that my wife and I both believed spent far too much time on his computer gaming when he was in middle school and high school. He's now a very successful and socially conscious engineer working in the electric power group for a city agency in Austin, Texas. He has often commented on the similarities between the software he now uses at work and the software he played with as a teenager." Dr. Greenfield?
Well, there is a fair amount of data that looks at some of the positive elements of gaming, both neurologically as well as socially. So I don't think there's any question that there are positive benefits. And again, when we look at people who are having issues with gaming, We're looking at extreme cases. We're looking at situations where their life has become, for lack of a better word, unmanageable, and that they need treatment to help them. And I agree with the other guest who said that mental health professionals and addictions professionals lack sophistication on how to address this. And often these patients are not treated appropriately, and they're not treated by people who have knowledge specifically about this issue. So it's not so simple.
I know we've got to let go of two of you at this point. Andrew Shabilsky, the Director of Research at the Oxford Internet Institute. Andrew, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks so much. Anytime.
And Dr. David Greenfield, founder of the Center for Internet and Technology Addiction and an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine. Thanks, doctor.
Thank you.
Ian, I wonder if I could just ask you something about the nature of these games. Carlos tweeted, game developers know their tricks work to keep us hitting the button for another treat, but they don't see using those methods to keep us playing and paying as being immoral or unethical. Isn't there something inherent about all video games that is designed to be so compelling that it could be addictive? I mean, if you don't get hooked on a game, doesn't that mean the game sucks?
Right. This is a really important point. Game designers sometimes talk about game design in terms of loops, these things that are called game loops. Games are repetitive. It's a weird medium. You do the same thing or a similar thing over and over and over again. And that's kind of the delight of games in a certain way, whereas normally we'd think of that as monotony or boredom. And when you play a game, you're kind of buying into that. You're saying, wow, what happens if I get better at this same action, or I learn how its structure works, or what it means to master it? That's what inspires people to come back into games to immerse themselves in the delight of their structures. If you think about gambling, by comparison, one of the reasons gambling is interesting to people is it allows you to face the power that money and that risk have over you, and you can go overboard in that, but facing that risk is intrinsically interesting. And likewise, you know, facing the repetition of life in all its forms of the cyclical, repetitive, again and again and again nature of existence, this is something that games have to offer us. The problem comes when you take that that idea of a loop and turn it into an excuse for compulsion itself. You'll sometimes hear this word compulsion loops in the design community. And that's when you see the design being used in that kind of manipulative way to draw in suckers who are willing to spend more of their time and money on a thing that might be benefiting the operator more than the player. I think we see that in social media as much as in games, if not more.
Before we got to let you go, Cecilia, where do you see this going from here? Will this classification have any impact on the way developers make games? Are game studios even paying attention to this?
It's hard to say, not being somebody who works at a game studio, whether they are taking gaming disorder and the conversation around it to heart. However, I do know that it is sparking a necessary conversation among mental health professionals and people who educate mental health professionals on how to treat this in patients they see.
Cecilia D'Anastasio is a senior reporter at the video game news site Kotaku. Cecilia, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
And Georgia Tech professor Ian Bogost, his latest book on video games is called Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secret of Games. Thanks, professor.
Thanks so much.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.